From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project with Allison Stewart and Luke Burbank. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News, where we've got your news, your information, a little dirty, dirty politics. I'm Luke Burbank.
And I'm Allison Stewart. It's Tuesday, October 30th. You just have one day to get your Halloween costume in order. And Luke, while you were away, you were seeing your daughter out in Seattle. Robert Smith posed a question to some of our listeners. What's a good news costume to have? He said, put on a t-shirt, the Don't Tase Me Bro guy. and we posted that on our blog. We got some good responses.
Yeah, somebody named Sarah said Arnold Schwarzenegger as disaster yoga instructor. That would be an Arnold mask, a yoga outfit and mat, and a couple of smoky smudges.
I like Petro. He says, been working out, have a fish to make out with, strip to the waist, and go as Pootie Poot Putin. Remember those pictures of Vladimir
when
Putin?
When he gave that kid a little... on his belly.
And he had the, and he was in a Field and Stream.
Yeah,
remember?
Yeah.
He was stripped down to his, I don't say pants in Russian, but.
Yeah. Somebody else suggested dressing up as a brush fire. I don't know. I was trying to get my kid to go as myths South Carolina,
such as
U.S. Americans, such as Iraq. I was going to be Lloyd Dobler from Say Anything, and I was going to have a trench coat and, like, holding a boombox, but...
Is that because you don't need a chick. You have a girlfriend.
Well,
that's
also,
what the
I have
point
nowhere
of
to,
that costume is.
Also, I go to bed at 6:30 at night, so that's going to make for a pretty quiet Halloween in the Burbank house. Okay, something that does cheer me up, though, is the fact that the Yankees do not get everything they want all the time. They lost A-Rod, or at least he opted out of his gigantic contract. We're going to talk about that move, and also the guy who represents Alex Rodriguez, Scott Boras, who some would say is the worst thing ever for baseball. We'll talk to Ben McGrath from The New Yorker about that.
Also, we're going to talk about dirty campaigns. Do you just yearn for a time when there wasn't dirty politics and politicians were all gentlemen? They were never like that, according to a new book. We detail how it was dirty all the way back to George Washington's day.
Also, music from The Go Team. Also, our big old news stories from our little old newscaster, Rachel Martin. First, though, we've got the BPP's big story.
Fires out west, parades in the northeast, deer hunting season. When local news makes national news, it's time for a regional roundup of big stories from all over the country.
In Boston, they're getting ready for a party. The world champion Red Sox will be the stars of a rolling rally, which we're pretty sure is just an alliterative term that means parade.
The event kicks off at noon at Fenway Park, then rolls through Beantown and ends near City Hall.
In Minneapolis, they're talking about construction of the new I-35W bridge, which is scheduled to begin Thursday. The replacement for the bridge that collapsed on August 1st is expected to cost $234 million and supposed to be finished by next Christmas.
Now in Los Angeles, the wildfires are still on the front page. A break in the Santa Ana winds is giving firefighters time to get those last few blazes under control, but it is a race against time because the winds are expected to return by the weekend.
Also out in L.A., they're talking baseball. The Dodgers, who have fired their manager, or they're planning on it, thinking about it, maybe replacing him with a guy named Joe Torre, who has been mentioned on this show even, the ex-Yankees manager. This is being reported, by the way, by the Westchester New York Journal News.
And we must check out the news in Vincennes, Indiana, one of the BPP's favorite towns, where the Sun Commercial newspaper is reporting that lower enrollment numbers in the North Knox County School District are translating into more restriction on capital projects.
Oh, I was wondering about that. And one more shout out to BPP land. We finish up in the east in Vermont, which most people know as BPP country. This weekend in Vermont is Youth Deer Hunting Weekend. Pack your s'mores and your shells. And kids, stay safe out there.
So there's some local flavor for you, courtesy of the BPP Big Story. Now the rest of the news with Rachel Martin.
This is NPR.
Hey, good morning, everyone. So we told you yesterday about U.S. State Department reports that said a man convicted in the bombing of a U.S. Navy ship in 2000 was unaccounted for and possibly had been released from prison. Now, State Department officials say they have confirmed that Jamal Badawi is still in detention. State Department spokesman Gonzalo Gallegos said they were able to verify Badawi's physical presence in prison in the Yemeni capital of Aden. Reports last week that Badawi had been released triggered the State Department to hold off on an aid package to Yemen. Badawi is serving 15 years over the attack that killed 17 American sailors. Six French nationals have been charged with kidnapping after a failed attempt to fly 103 Sudanese children from Darfur to France. The French citizens work for a charity organization called L'Arche de Zoe, which designated the kids as orphans. The group had arranged French host families for the children to save them from possible death in Sudan's war-ravaged Darfur region. Officials in Chad detained a total of 17 people after the charity tried to put the children on a plane last week. Chad's president called it outright kidnapping. The case comes as the European Union prepares a peacekeeping force in Chad to help refugees along its borders with Darfur, and the alleged kidnapping could complicate the peacekeeping operation. A suicide bomb went off just a couple miles from Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf's army headquarters in the town of Rawalpindi, killing seven people. The attacker blew himself up next to a police checkpoint close to the residence of one of Musharraf's most senior officers. The deputy of information for the government said Musharraf was safely in his home office at the time of the blast. Meanwhile, police in Pakistan have released a photograph of the man they say carried out the bombing attack earlier this month in Karachi, which killed 130 people. The attack was aimed at former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto's convoy. Bhutto had just returned to Pakistan after years in exile when the two blasts hit near her vehicle. Pakistan's newspaper showed pictures of the suspected bomber today. Results of an initial investigation into the bombing are expected next week. So Andrew Meyer, the University of Florida student who yelled this now infamous phrase,
"Don't chase me, bro!"
Love that. Well, it looks like Meyer will not face criminal charges for causing a big brouhaha at a political rally last month. Meyer kicked up an international spectacle after he demanded a chance to question Senator John Kerry about the 2004 presidential race during a campus rally. Officers rushed Meyer after he kept shouting questions, finally shocking him in a scuffle that was broadcast widely on the internet. Meyer's defense attorney says 21-year-old Meyer has since written apologies to the Gainesville school, its president, and campus police. That's the news, and it's always online at npr.org.
This is NPR.
Luke and Allison, back to you.
Well, thank you very much, Rachel. Huge baseball news this week. No, not that the Boston Red Stockings won another World Series. Seriously, who cares? Who do they beat? The Colorado Laser Cats or something? It was the most forgettable World Series.
All right, the state of Colorado, the last name is Burbank. Right to that man.
Oh, come on. I'm from Seattle, the only team that's less well-known than the Rockies. Anyway, the big news this week, a lot of people would say, was that Alex Rodriguez, you know him as A-Rod, announced that he will take advantage of an escape clause in his 10-year, $252 million contract and become a free agent, thus parting ways with the New York Yankees. A big player in that decision, no doubt, was A-Rod's agent, a guy named Scott Boras. He's the same agent who negotiated that record-breaking deal 10 years ago. Scott Boras has been involved in some of the biggest contracts in pro sports, and depending on who you ask, might be the worst person in pro sports today. Ben McGrath, a staff writer at the New Yorker magazine, wrote an excellent piece on Scott Boras recently entitled "The Extortionist," if that gives you any thought about how some people feel about Scott Boras. And he's here now to talk to us about this. Hi, Ben.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Thanks for coming on the BPP.
No problem.
So why is Scott Boras a guy who gets people so riled up?
Well, partly I think it's that he's motivated much more than most fans would expect by a real sort of sense of righteousness. He believes that he's not really a sports agent. He's an attorney who's working for on the side of labor, and he's working to improve this game of baseball, which he himself once played at the minor league level. And everything he does, in the way he talks about the game and his players, is infused with this sense of real high-minded moral purpose, which I think catches a lot of fans by surprise.
Do they have a hard time with it? Because it seems hard to be moralizing when a guy's making $25 million a year or whatever.
I think that's probably...
Yeah, I tend to think of A-Rod as labor.
I think that's a big part of it. And I think a lot of people have a hard time thinking of A-Rod as labor, especially major league pitchers, maybe even more so, who go out and pitch once every 5 days. But that is definitely the way he sees it. He sees the owners as, you know, fat cat capitalists. And A-Rod, however rich he is, he's you can look at it as A-Rod is setting an example for all the younger players. The more money A-Rod makes, the more it trickles down. It really, there's a kind of Ronald Reagan era economic idea about the way the way money works in baseball.
Yeah, you write in your piece that baseball players seem to be big fans of trickle-down economics. So they all love Scott Boras even if he doesn't rep them because they feel like A-Rod gets 25 mil, they might get 2 mil.
I think they do. I mean, I talked to a couple of players, even some ex-players who didn't make very much money at the time. They were playing Keith Hernandez, who made, I think, probably about $1 or $2 million a year when he was playing 20 years ago. And they tend to have a kind of go, baby, go attitude about this. You know, get what you can. It's about time that we can make what we once didn't make.
I think maybe to get a sense for Scott Boras, maybe it's useful to talk about other agents, maybe more traditional agents. How do most of them operate versus Scott Boras?
Well, there are about 300 of them, and there's a reason you haven't heard of most of them.
Right.
I think Gene Orza, who is the number two guy at the union, the Players Association, has referred to a lot of agents as hobbyists, and the implication is that these are guys who, to some degree, really like hanging around baseball players. They like driving fancy cars. It's a way to be out at the clubs with, you know, it's being in a high entertainment situation, but it's not about really running a business. And the main thing I heard from every single person I talked to about Scott Boras, when I would ask them, what is it that distinguishes him and makes him so good, is that he's very well prepared. And that's you would think of that as a kind of a benchmark in most industries. Preparation should go without saying, and it's being unprepared that you would think is notable. And yet in Scott Boras's case, the fact that he's prepared and not to take anything away from him, this somehow distinguishes him from most agents who are thought to be more like Jerry Maguire, I think, kind of running on attitude.
He doesn't like that comparison, you write.
He doesn't.
There's a guy named Lee Steinberg, who's an NFL agent, who always brags he was based on Jerry Maguire. But Scott Boras isn't a flashy guy like that?
He's not. In fact, he doesn't use the word agent to describe himself.
Oh, no. What does he use?
He calls himself an attorney who happens to represent people who play a sport called baseball. He doesn't represent players in other sports, and he doesn't. He represents baseball players in the way that Bruce Cutler represents mafia,
or Phil Spector for a certain period of time.
Can I ask a real basic question? Just sure. What does he look like? Who plays him in Scott Boras the movie? Just so I have a visual.
Steve Carell, maybe.
Steve, it's kind of cross between Steve Carell and Randy Quaid, maybe.
Okay.
He's got
a beautiful man.
He's got a fleshier face than Steve Carell, but he's kind of got a meaty face, and he's got his hair is kind of very neatly composed and not too. He's thick in the chest. He's a mm-hmm. former athlete himself, and
I just needed a visual as we were talking.
Yeah,
about
I actually did a Google image search this morning because there's a drawing of him associated with your New Yorker piece, but I wanted to see a real photo. I had the same thought. Well, let's take it back to A-Rod just as we sort of wrap things up here. Do you think A-Rod decided to opt out of his contract because Scott Boras told him so, or because he's just tired of playing in New York?
I think I'm sure that he believes that he opted out because he wanted to leave New York. I think there's case could be made that Scott Boras had convinced him of how many great opportunities there were elsewhere. That, to what extent it was his own idea is debatable. But it's not hard to think that he wasn't loving New York, mm-hmm. where the fans never really quite warmed to him. Derek Jeter was always the real Yankee.
Yeah. And do you think Scott Boras getting all this money for these players, treating it very dispassionately, as it sounds like he does, as a business and as a sort of legal transaction? Good or bad for baseball, you think?
I think that's probably for other people to decide. I would argue that he's not bad for baseball in the sense that players should be able to make the money that they didn't once make. What he misses, I think, sometimes is the sense that the way about which he does his job is not the same thing as the ideas that are animating them. And I think he has a sense that if you're criticizing him, it's because you don't understand that baseball is no longer a feudal system and that you're just a romantic. Mm. And it's possible to believe that money does influence baseball and also believe that you needn't be incredibly arrogant in the way you go about working for the players.
Did you ask him about repping me? I mean, I'm 31. My fastball isn't what it used to be, but I think he could probably still get me like 5 million.
I think he probably could. And
that's how good Scott Boras is.
And to go back to your last question, I mean, I think one of the things that you have to think is, imagine you had a son playing baseball. As much as you may think that it's unfortunate what's happening to the game, you might well want Scott Boras to be representing your son.
Yeah. Ben McGrath, writer for the New Yorker magazine, excellent piece on Scott Boras called The Extortionist. It's in last week's issue. You can still check it out, I'm sure, at thenewyorker.com. Thank you for coming on the Bryant Park Project.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you. No problem.
Coming up, we're going to talk about dirty campaigns. Turns out mudslinging is not an invention of 2007.
And if you want to know what the word mojographia is, you may actually have it, believe it or not, Luke Burbank.
Scott Boras has it.
Then you need to stick around. He might have it, actually. That's coming up on the Bryant Park Project. Back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. I'm Allison Stewart. I'm Luke Burbank. And I just called him a dord, which is what we were kind of laughing at. But you don't know what that means, do you?
No, which I guess makes me a total dord.
Or the word grok? Or
nope.
How about the derivation of the word window?
Nope.
Nope. Well, when it comes to word history, our next guest puts it all into perspective. Each word has a little bit of a linguistic biography, and he has taken it upon himself to be the unofficial biographer of some of the most mundane and some of the oddest building blocks of the English vocabulary. His new book is called The Dord, The Diglot, and An Avocado or Two. Here to tell us what each one means is Anu Garg. Hi, Anu.
Hi, Allison.
What's a dord?
Oh, dord. Dord is an example of a ghost word. So yes, the Halloween is around the corner, but in the world of lexicography, in dictionaries also, there are ghost words. So ghost word is a word that is coined by error.
Oh.
What
coined
does that
mean?
Error.
So it's like a mistake?
Exactly. Even dictionary editors make mistakes.
One of the funniest things about your book is you have a chapter called These Words Basically, they sound like they're made up words. And my favorite was Zeitgeber. It's like Zeitgeist's little brother. What's a Zeitgeber?
Yeah. Zeitgeber is an environmental cue, for example, light, that helps us or any living being to regulate the biological clock. So now the daylight saving time change is coming up, and guess what? Maybe your Zeitgeber is going to get a little bit off.
Oh, I can work that in next week.
Yeah, use that at the cocktail party on Friday.
So all words give you opportunity to use, even though they are unusual words.
Other words are so simple and easy to understand. The word window, but it has almost a poetic derivation. Explains the derivation of the word window.
Yeah. Well, window is an example of the fascinating etymology or the history of words that words have. So window comes from Old Norse, and the origin is that window is a wind's eye.
The wind's eye.
In other words, if you open the window, guess what? Wind comes in.
I would think they would call it the house's eye, because aren't you opening the house's eye?
Well, unless you have a window as big as, you know,
house.
The whole side of the wall.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's a good point.
There's this other issue in the book is about how words' meanings can sometimes change over time and how, for example, the word resent has had a shift in its meaning. What was the original meaning of resent?
Well, we got the word resent from French, resentir, meaning to feel. And you could feel love or joy or sorrow. But when it came to English, it took an entirely different meaning, even though in French it is still a neutral word. So language is like a river which just keeps on flowing, and sometimes it changes directions.
I have to ask you something personal about you. I looked at your resume. Now, you have a degree in computer science from Case Western Reserve. How did you get so tangled up in words and loving words?
Well, that was my former life. You know, as
when you were adored.
I'm originally from India, and India especially, when a child is born, parents ask him, so, do you want to be a doctor or an engineer? Because they know if you are a writer or a sculptor or a painter, you can't make a living. So guess what? I became an engineer.
But you always had this love, this passion for language, it sounds like.
And when the web came along, I figured this would be a great way to share my love of words with other people.
Right, your website. Explain to people about your website.
So wordsmith.org, I started it back in the Jurassic era of the internet, 1994, before there was Google or eBay. So wordismy.org is an online community of word lovers, people who enjoy language and words. So every day I share a new word, and people just enjoy learning about its etymology, its history, where the word came from.
Well, there's one that I have to know. I want you to I know what it means. I have to admit, because I read the book, but I just like the sound of it. Mojographia. If I have mojographia, what's wrong with me?
Well, that's a word that I have a personal experience with. Mojographia is a writer's cramp.
Oh.
So, well, you say, oh, I have writer's cramp. Huh. It doesn't sound much like it. Now you say, I have mojographia.
Oh. Well, I'm so sorry to hear that.
You have something. Yeah. Special going on.
Where do we send the flowers?
Yeah.
You must believe there's something more than just a gee whiz factor to finding out the weird meanings and the backgrounds or the funny sounds of these words. What do you think is the bigger picture benefit, Anu?
Well, the way I look at words is paints on your palette. So you don't have to use all these words in a single painting, but if a word fits somewhere, I don't see anything wrong with using it. So each word helps us to convey our ideas, our thoughts, exactly what we have them in our mind. So you want to find just the right word to describe what you have thought of.
The name of the book is The Dord, The Diglot, and An Avocado or Two. I'm not going to tell you about the other two, so you can go read Anu's book. I don't want to give it all away. Anu Garg, thank you so much for joining us.
You are very welcome.
Well, lest anyone get mojographia, you might want to just keep it on the computer today and check out some of the more emailed and read stories on the net. Or you could just listen to the next, I don't know, what is it, 7 minutes? How long is this thing in for? Where we actually bring together for you some of the most emailed, some of the most read stories on the interwebs, and we provide it for you in a segment we call The Most.
First up, Dan Pashman. What did you find this morning, Dan?
Hey, guys. How you doing? I got two quick ones for you. New York Times most emailed. FCC set to end sole cable deals for apartments. If you live in an apartment, it can be frustrating because one company has a monopoly in the apartment and your cable rates can be up through the roof. Well, they're going to let cable companies compete for the same apartment building. You could have different cable companies working in the same building. So that's big news.
That is big news.
For people in apartments. And also, other end of the spectrum sort of here, most emailed off Yahoo News, top office pet peeves. I'm sure we can all relate to this one. Number one pet peeve, aside from gossiping coworkers, which people find annoying, and people who organize
their
home lives.
Which, you know, who
lives.
Does that all the time?
Who's
is
that?
Manola.
You know, that's what I heard.
Yeah. And the other top office pet peeve is people who hit reply all on emails.
Oh, I have an entire folder in my inbox of those special emails that come through.
And we're here in New York.
I just keep them.
Most of those NPR
funny.
Friends of ours in D.C., they have email things going on, and we don't know what's going on, but a lot of reply alls happen there.
Yeah, here's a tip. Yeah. If it's a size 16 Comic Sans font with 9 exclamation points, probably not something you need to share with everyone at NPR. All right, MJ Davis has something about... Where is this from, by the way?
This is from the LA Times. It's an article called Germany Seeks Expansion of Computer Spying. And basically, Germany is seeking the authority to plant surveillance viruses called Trojan viruses in computers of terrorism suspects. And the viruses can trace every keystroke and turn on their microphones and webcams to track what they're doing. It's very, like... cool spy movie kind of things, but they have a history of the Gestapo and a very controlling surveillance police department from East Germany, and so there's a lot of resistance to this right now, and they're claiming that it stems from U.S. tactics post 9/11. So it's a really interesting story about the backlash against surveillance tactic approaches.
And that is from the LA Times most emailed. Okay, Ilya, we've got you on the Midwest beat.
Yeah, this is I moved over to Minnesota, though. This is a really distressing
story. Yes, you were focusing closely on North Dakota.
South Dakota's next.
Okay.
It's in my bullseye. This is the story of three apparently very important Finnish musicians who were detained at the Minneapolis airport. So this is the second important news event to happen there this year.
At that airport,
yeah. It wasn't in the bathroom, though.
Wasn't a toe tapper, though.
No. Well, they might have been, because they're musicians. This is good music. In fact, it's so good that one of the musicians has been called the Bruce Springsteen of Finland. His name is Jukka Karjalainen. Forgive me, but I think we have a clip of him here if you're ready to play it.
Veisa muittia juomari poika, se on arvollensa.
Kyllä se lankaa. He's singing about the Garden State Parkway. He is
Wait,
like Bruce Springsteen.
I love this stuff. It's
are you sure that isn't Pastor Dooney?
Actually, it's me. It's from my MySpace.
He sounds like the Finnish Tom Waits.
Jukka Karjalainen is my fake MySpace name. I do want to just read to you from their complaint book, because it is so incredibly sad. This is the official complaint from the musicians. They threatened us with severe punishments if we talk to each other. Through the walls, I can hear officers yelling, screaming. They ask about the purpose of our trip, except we are only allowed to give yes or no answers. I try to talk about our plans to meet with Finnish-American folk musicians. Nobody listens. They interrupt me constantly, and they yell, "You are a liar." So
they're still a little amped up after the Larry Craig thing.
Somebody needs to get to the bottom of this. Overzealous law enforcement at the Minneapolis airport.
All right, that's Ilya Meretz. I'm going to yield my time to the good lady from Secaucus, New Jersey. That would be our editor, Tricia McKinney.
Hey, I got to press the button right. We got to learn our button pressing in Secaucus, New Jersey. So I have one of the most emailed on Yahoo News. And you know how in journalism school they teach you, you know, dog bites man, not a headline. Man bites dog, that's a headline. How about
that's
what
they taught me at DeVry,
right.
Journalism school.
How about dogs shoot man?
Ooh.
Headline.
So apparently a pack of hunting dogs shot an Iowa man as he went to retrieve a fallen pheasant. The guy apparently placed his firearm on the ground, climbed a fence, and then one of the dogs stepped on the gun and shot him right in the leg.
Oh. He's so, okay, though?
You know, honestly, I've been trying to find out how he's doing. He was treated at a regional medical center and then airlifted to an Iowa City hospital, so I'm really hoping he's okay.
Mad dog.
Yeah, seriously.
So, Matt, do we have time for yours and mine, or should I just yield to you?
I'm sorry. That's me moving the mic. Radio professional. we do have time for both of ours. You want to go first?
I'll go first.
Okay.
Okay, this is from the New York Post, so you know it's true. It's the second most emailed story, Daddy's 10 Million Bad Bar Mitzvah. This was a story of legend in New York City about this man who threw his daughter a $10 million bat mitzvah, included performances by Aerosmith, 50 Cent, Tom Petty, and the Eagles. So how did he pay for it? Apparently out of his company's pocket. He headed to court. Now, here's also something that makes it just a little bit nastier. This guy is a former CEO of a leading supplier of body armor for U.S. soldiers in Iraq.
How's that going?
Yeah, right. Over there. Charged yesterday with looting the company to bankroll not only this bat mitzvah, but also a facelift for his ex-wife, vitamins for his stable of 100 horses, and a 100,000 diamond-studded belt buckle.
How about that?
So there you go.
There you go.
You always wonder, how do they pay for that? do you pay for a $10 million bat mitzvah? Well, apparently, fleecing our troops.
I have the number one emailed story from NPR.org, as usual. It's Joe Palca's piece from Morning Edition yesterday that shows that vibrations seem to make people thinner. Well, not people, mice.
mice people.
Mice people. No, biomedical engineer Clinton Rubin found out that when mice are jiggled for a certain time, they actually gain bone mass. And here it is... here's a little bit from the piece of, you know, why that may be.
The theory for why vibrations affect bone mass is that somehow the stem cells that make bone sense the motion and say, hey, I think I'll turn into bone so I can tolerate all this jiggling. But if that theory is right, Rubin realized something.
If a precursor cell is deciding to become bone, maybe it isn't becoming fat.
So he and his colleagues at the State University of New York in Stony Brook set up a little experiment. He gave two groups of mice identical diets, but one group he put on a gently vibrating platform for 15 minutes a day. Then he measured the body fat of the group that got the daily jiggling.
Sure enough, they had 27% less fat 15 weeks later.
And stronger bones.
There we go. Stronger bones.
Joe Palca is a recurring character on this show.
It's true.
Even when he's not actually on here live, we're playing tapes of him because he does excellent work.
Yes, we were having a little discussion about when we do our most stories. A lot of these stories are stories that are in the works. So, for example, this man allegedly bilked his company out of the money.
Yes,
he's been charged with it.
Yes,
make sure we say that clearly.
Thank you. We don't want to try and convict him here on the air. That's for off the air when we go back to the bullpen. And that, by the way, is the most.
Even Barack Obama, who pledged not to go there this campaign season, has now told the New York Times he plans to get tough on his main rival for the Democratic nomination. So the senator from Illinois is planning to get into it with the senator from New York. When pointing out differences becomes pointed and then turns to mean-spirited duck because the mud is about to be slung. And it isn't a modern phenomenon. No matter how much people want to believe that political discourse has descended to some horrible base level, it's always been base, in the gutter and full of cheap shots. And they are laid out quite nicely in the book Anything for a Vote, written by Joe Cummins. Hi, Joe.
Hey, how you doing, Allison?
I'm great. I do have a question, though. Why do so many people believe mudslinging is such a modern development?
Well, I think basically because people have always been taught in their civic classes that voting is their patriotic duty and that, you know, the American democratic process is really the best way of life on earth. And in fact, it's a fantastic process. But I think the real history beyond the civic classes has been hidden. And I don't think people really know too much about these dirty tricks because, in fact, up until 1972 in the Watergate years, many of them weren't even reported. And so people do think they're a new development when they see them happening this day. But, of course, they're as American as apple pie.
Let's look back at the founding fathers who got into one of the meanest fights. One of the top five meanest contests in history, you say, was in 1800 with Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. You write, the only thing missing was Monica, as in Lewinsky. Can you give me an example how dirty this race got?
Well, it got really nasty because, of course, John Adams was running against his own vice president, Thomas Jefferson, which is something that has never happened again in American history. And the two parties, which were the Federalists of Adams and the Republicans of Jefferson, really went at it tooth and nail. I mean, Jefferson secretly hired a hack writer to call Adams a repulsive pedant and a gross hypocrite. And most interesting of all, a hideous hermaphroditical character which has neither the force and firmness of a man nor the gentleness and sensibility of a woman.
I don't think I've ever heard one candidate call another a hermaphrodite before on
exactly.
The trail.
Can you imagine that happening today if someone came out and someone called Mitt Romney or, or, or Hillary or hermaphrodite. Can you imagine the uproar that would ensue?
How about Herbert Hoover versus Al Smith, one of the worst campaign tactics in 1928, the use of Smith's Catholicism against him? Tell our listeners about those pamphlets about one of the tunnels in New York.
Well, yeah, Al Smith was the governor of New York, and of course he was the first Catholic to try to run for president in the United States against Herbert Hoover, and he was presided over the building of the Holland Tunnel, and so Republicans published pictures of him standing in front of the entrance of the Holland Tunnel with his hard hat and his pike and his shovel, and they passed these around the American Southwest and West, and they said that actually Al Smith had built the tunnel to lead not to New Jersey, but actually all the way 3,000 miles under the Atlantic Ocean to the Vatican, which is where he would meet secretly with the Pope to get his marching orders on how to run the country.
So the Pope would be running the United States,
right,
ultimately.
Through Al Smith.
All right, let's talk about recently. I found this interesting. You write about some of the sleazy tricks that Lyndon Johnson's people used against Barry Goldwater that were completely unethical. What did his camp do that stuck, that actually worked?
Well, I always believe, and this is the election of 1964, that had people found out the amount of dirty tricks that Lyndon Johnson did, he might have been impeached, as Richard Nixon almost was. His campaign set up a secret committee called the 5 o'clock Club, which met after hours in Washington, and which plotted tricks against Goldwater. And there were a whole panoply of tricks. One thing they did was they wrote hundreds of letters to Ann Landers pretending to be innocent citizens, horrified at the thought of a Goldwater victory. They also influenced some financial columnists to write columns which said that Wall Street would be devastated if Goldwater won. And most interestingly, and I think most devastatingly, Lyndon Johnson sent E. Howard Hunt into the Goldwater campaign to pretend to be a Goldwater volunteer, and Hunt was able to feed copies of Goldwater's speeches to the Johnson political people.
Can you imagine if these guys had had the internet, what they would have been capable of?
Oh, my God. This was just all done pre-internet with nothing but good old-fashioned American dirty tricks know-how, you know, so.
We're going to look forward. We don't know exactly how ugly it's going to get, but in the appendix of your book, you have the top 10 classic attacks in a presidential election. I'm going to ask you to pick out which one of these you think will end up being employed. I'm going to run them down for our listeners. At number 10, you're not tough enough. At number 9, you'll drive us into war. You're too old. You're an egghead. You're an idiot. You're a slut. You're clearly not having sex with anyone. You're at least a little bit gay. That one was about Buchanan and Adlai Stevenson. You're drunk all the time, and you're insane. So those are the top 10 classic attacks. Of all of those, what do you think we'll see in 2008, and against whom?
Well, I think we're going to see you'll drive us into war a great deal. And I think we're going to see the Democrats using that a great deal against the Republicans. But in general, they all think each other is insane. So generally, I think that both Republicans and Democrats will be claiming the others are quite crazy.
All right. So we plan to see the crazy tactic in OA. Hey, Joe Cummins, the author of the book Anything for a Vote. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, Allison. I appreciate it.
We want to wish Joe well. He was actually supposed to be a live guest this morning, but he's a runner and he was short of breath. Found out he needed to get stents put in today. So he did that interview late yesterday, knowing he had to have surgery either today or tomorrow. So good wishes out to Joe.
Good luck, Joe. Boy, coming up on the BPP, the Go Team, England's finest pop-funk rap combo thing.
That explains it.
Which involves, yeah, that was really helpful. Well, this is a song off their new record, Proof of Youth. It's called My World. We're going to talk to them coming up on the BPP.
Next time on the Bryant Park Project.
A tour through Transylvania, drinking your own blood, being locked in
Luke, could you just read this?
Yeah, okay. We have a new book that takes us on a journey through the world of vampires.
Plus, singer Jill Sobule has some things to say about skimpy Halloween costumes.
That's next time on the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. We're always available online at npr.org/Bryant Park. I'm Allison Stewart.
And I'm Luke Burbank. Coming up, we have a conversation with the British band The Go Team. You have to say that because they have an exclamation point
yes.
after the Go. They stopped by to talk about their sophomore record. It's called Proof of Youth. That's coming up in a minute. First, though, we've got today's top stories with Rachel Martin.
This is NPR.
Hey, good morning, everyone. It looks like a top official at the Federal Emergency Management Agency is going to lose his job over a fake FEMA press conference staged last week. According to reports, FEMA's Director of External Communications, Pat Philbin, has been denied a promotion, making him the highest-ranking casualty of a news conference staged by FEMA to publicize its response to California's wildfires. Philbin was scheduled to become Director of Public Affairs for the Director of National Intelligence, but officials with the agency said yesterday Philbin will not be assuming that post. Meanwhile, FEMA's chief, David Paulison, has announced reforms in the Office of External Affairs to try to, quote, restore the agency's integrity and make sure that nothing like this happens again, end quote. There's new fallout in the investigation into the private security firm Blackwater USA, and it doesn't reflect well on the U.S. State Department. According to the Associated Press, State Department investigators offered Blackwater guards immunity during an inquiry into last month's deadly shooting of 17 Iraqi civilians in Baghdad. Yesterday, government officials said the guards agreed to speak only after receiving the immunity protection, which says their statement can only be used internally, not for criminal prosecutions. But apparently, these State Department investigators didn't have the authority to grant this immunity. The closed-door deal has delayed a criminal inquiry into the shooting, and it could undermine efforts to prosecute Blackwater guards who were involved. Meanwhile, Iraq's government is taking its own steps to crack down on Blackwater and other firms. Iraq's cabinet has today approved a law that would remove immunity previously granted to private security firms working in Iraq and instead make the foreign security agencies accountable under Iraqi laws. And a third man embroiled in the O.J. Simpson armed robbery case has pled guilty to reduced charges in return for his testimony against Simpson. 49-year-old Michael McClinton told a Las Vegas judge he'll plead guilty to robbery and conspiracy to commit robbery. McClinton wielded a gun and posed as a police officer on September 13th when Simpson and five other men confronted a sports collectibles dealer at a Vegas hotel. McClinton's testimony contradicts Simpson, who insists that no guns were involved in the incident. And finally, this was supposed to be the big day in China, the opening of ticket sales for the 2008 Beijing Olympics, but there were some glitches. And the online ticketing system crashed. Tickets went on sale on a first-come, first-served basis, but about 8 hours into it, the online ticketing system had a note saying the system was busy and customers should check back later. Chinese officials say about 9,000 tickets were sold out of the total 1.85 million available. Organizers say they're working to repair the problem, and they've asked buyers to just be patient. That's the news, and it's always online at npr.org.
This is NPR.
Luke and Allison, back to you.
That's Lady Flash off the Go Team's last record, Thunder, Lightning, Strike. They've got a new album coming out called Proof of Youth. It's actually out already. We're going to hear some more of that in a moment. As the story goes, a few years ago, a guy named Ian Parton was hanging out in his Brighton, England home, trying to find a way to combine some of his favorite sounds, which included Sonic Youth, Double Dutch Chants, Car Chase Horns. And so he and his brother started mashing stuff together in their parents' kitchen, and when it came time to play some real shows, they pieced together a couple of drummers, a bassist, another guitar player, a rapper slash vocalist named Ninja, and hence the Go Team was born. And by coincidence, the Go Team joins us here, members of the Go Team, in the Bryant Park Project studios. We've got Jamie Bell on bass, Sam Hello. Duke, multi-instrumentalist, and of course, Ninja. Hi, guys.
Hello.
How are you doing?
How you doing?
I'm great. I just got done watching this documentary on YouTube that shows your exploits, and it showed a whole bunch of live shows you've done around the world. Would it be safe to say you have more fun than any band in the history of music?
I'd like to think so. I'd think that we should maybe go into the Guinness World Book of Records and maybe tell them that we have. They have to get a phonometer, an instrument that measures levels of fun, and I think that we definitely hit the top, or maybe even break it. They'd have to get a new one for someone else who thinks they have more fun than us.
I think you guys definitely broke the phonometer on a couple of these clips that I saw. I mean, you're drenched in sweat. You're pulling little kids up from the side of the audience in Chicago.
Yeah, their parents weren't too happy about that because they're holding hands with their parents. We pulled them up and some people, you know, fell down to the ground and stuff, and it turned into quite a disaster movie.
What do you do? I just want to keep moving past that in case there's any kind of lawsuit or liability.
No children were hurt in the making of the Pitchfork Festival.
Your whole kind of reason for being on stage anyway seems to be to just have fun and get the party going. What do you do when you show up in some random town and you're feeling tired and you got to go put on this giant event?
I go and find real Americans. I find them quite entertaining. Like when you're jet lagged, go and talk to a real American. Like I've met some who don't know that there are black people in England, and some who don't know where England is, and some people think my accent is Italian. I've heard that before. Yes, real Americans are very entertaining.
Well, I understand that when you guys put the first record out, or before actually, there were some problems because there was a bunch of samples on there that you guys had to re-record or something. What happened?
Well, some of them, the record came out and now nothing was cleared. We just got put out anyway because wasn't expected to sell particularly, and the effort going into clearing samples, it cost us a stack of cash. So it just got put out, and then later on when people carried on buying it, and we wanted to release it over here, then we had to sort out the legal aspect of things.
And what about the legal that couldn't be sorted out? Did you just re-record, you know, the Jackson 5 or something?
We had to work with a musicologist for a little bit, like, which is a really strange job. I don't think there's only several of them in the UK where, like, someone who's, like, field of expertise is judging whether something is, you know, copyright material, whether it's a rhythm or a melody. And
do you remember a specific song off of that record where there was a key part of it that you had to sort of take a hard look at?
Well, there were lots of bits and pieces. I mean, I remember personally I had to redo like the banjo part and VIP, and that was quite hard. It's really hard because, you know, there's an essence to that sample that it's really hard to sort of put your finger on it.
That's you re-recording. What was the original?
That was everybody's
playing banjo.
Yeah, everybody's talking. It's like a little banjo loop, so we had to redo that. Yeah.
Do you guys show up in the studio and someone has a guitar riff and then someone adds in some bass and then you write the vocals? How does one of these songs come together? Because they are such a kind of, pastiche.
Yeah, that's a bit Coldplay. Yeah, no, we don't work like that.
You're not down with the Chris Martin style?
No, that's it's kind of Ian goes out shopping for dusty records and he just gets ideas from documentaries and he just gets ideas and he puts the ideas together to form a song, and then we're involved in the recording process. So it's like, it's just a bunch of ideas. It's not so much, right, time to write a song, cup of tea, guitar, you know, pen and paper. It doesn't really work like that.
But you show up and then there's some music and you just start freestyling?
Ian gives me a call or an email and he says, "All right, here's a song, can you write to it?" And I'm like, "Write what?" He's like, "Oh, just write some lyrics." I'm like, "What kind of lyrics? Just, you know, just whatever. And I'm like, about what? And he's like, oh, anything you want. I'm like, you know, is there a title? What's my motivation? Give me something. He's like, I don't know. I'm like, Ian, give me something to go on. It's really frustrating because as a rapper, I'm trained to write about something. You know, I'm about the poetry and the lyrics and the, you know, and it's like with the Go Team, it's more about the music and not so much about the lyrics. So I've had to train myself to write about nothing. Literally, it's like some of the songs aren't about anything at all. It's just really rhythmic and catchy. And or he'll go, oh, I'll write something cheeky. And it's like cheeky is the most I'll get. And then I'll have to work with that one word and make a song cheeky. And sometimes I'll just make it up. I'll be like, right, I'm going to give this song its own title and its own, you know, story. And then I'll kind of go off on a tangent and stuff. So it's really hard. It's like, you know, I don't know. It's like asking someone to make you, a dress. There you go. Imagine yourself wearing a dress.
Mm-hmm. Not hard to
and
do.
And like, what kind of dress? Just a dress. Where the hell, you know, what? You know, so that's the feeling that I get.
Is there a line on a song on the new record that you wrote and you thought, this is just jibber-jabber, this is never making it?
Yeah, there's a whole song, like with The Wrath of Marcy.
What's the song called?
The Wrath of Marcy. I started off, I was like, right, I used to call The Wrath of Mikey. I was like, right, Mikey's going to be this guy, you know, and he's, you know, he's getting his own back and something's happened to him and, you know, people have, you know, it was a story. And then we had to re-record it for the new album and then I had to change it and Ian just again threw out Cheeky. And then it was just, I don't even know what I'm talking about anymore. I'm not talking about anything at all. And then I took it to studio. I was like, oh, you know, he said cheeky. He's not going to like this, but here you go. And he's like, oh, it's perfect. I was like, no, it doesn't mean anything. He goes, no, it's perfect. And I thought, okay, I'll do this for the album and I'll do something else on stage because it's too wordy. It's really fast and it's really wordy. There's no space to take a breath or anything. And I just ended up doing it on stage anyway. So it's a really hard song to do on stage.
Could you just give me like 5 seconds of it, 10 seconds of it?
It's a fiasco at your back door once again. Run up at your hop for it. Catch me if you can. Hop to it, step to it, jiggity jump. A bigger bang coming at you with a boogity bump. What? What? What am I talking about? This is Ian's fault. He's allowed this. I don't know. It's a fun song.
How do you judge if the show is going really well? Is it that musically you're playing really tight, or is it that people are going bananas?
Well, it's both really, but I mean, there's times when like we can do a show and people can go nuts, and it'll like it's been a good show, but one of us will be pissed off because like we're buggered up. Like this fill or whatever, you know, or like, or my guitar didn't work, or like, yeah, various things we can still like, because I can come off stage and think, oh, that was terrible, but like everyone in the audience had their hands in the air and stuff like that, you know.
And it's different in different countries as well.
What's the calmest place you guys have played where people just stand there?
Calmest?
I mean, where is the place where people show the least enthusiasm, but you still know they're enjoying it?
Everywhere's different, really. But I know, remember we played at a festival in Norway and we had a massive crowd. It's like a festival, you know, you can go and see different bands and stuff, and they came to see us and it was they're pretty, you know, laid back, but you can, you know, they're all nodding their heads in time, and like it's like wind, it's like a breeze blowing grass when you can see all the grass sort of bowing at the same time. It's like that, everyone's nodding at the same time.
A field of Norwegian heads.
Yes, and thousands, you know.
Japan was quite strange like that as well when we played Fuji Rock. Like after the song, there was just like
dead silence.
Dead silence. We're like, oh God, we're going down like a lead balloon. And then they're waiting, and then they clap.
Yeah, they're waiting for you to go, the song is finished, and they go, yeah! And then they stop, and they're waiting for you to like introduce the next song, and like, they're that polite. It's just they just
you were talking about Sigur Rós earlier. They played there as well.
Yeah, they're dead to us on this show. But
the audience just completely, there was just not a whisper for the whole set. I've never seen anything like that. It was amazing.
That was like the interview that we did. Not a whisper the entire time. Well, listen, Go Teamers, you're going to be in Washington, D.C. at the 9:30 Club, and I just want to thank you very much for coming in. Ninja with the vocals.
And I play the recorder.
Oh, also the recorder. I'm
and
sorry.
The tambourine.
I'm sorry.
And I play the drums on one side. See, multi-talented I am.
Multi-talented vocalist, tambourine, rapper,
vocals,
instrumentalist.
You can't get better than that.
Ninja, Jamie Bell on bass, and Sam Duke also on various instruments. Thank you very much for coming on the Bryant Park Project.
Thank you.
Those are some members of the Go team. Again, thanks to Ninja.
She is personality plus.
Oh, my gosh.
Love
she
her.
Was a living doll. Bassist Jamie Bell and Sam Duke, who plays guitar and banjo and drums. They have dates coming up in Washington, Philadelphia, and they're going to be on David Letterman tomorrow night.
Oh, the TiVo, the DVR will be employed.
But we've got them here first on the BPP. Their new record is called Proof of Youth.
And that is it for this Tuesday edition of the Bryant Park Project, but we never really leave you alone. We're also always online at npr.org/Bryant Park.
Our qualified, certified Angus Prime BPP staff includes MJ Davis, Ilya Marit, Stan Pashman, Wynn Rosenfeld, and Carrie Toby.
Manoli Weatherall, Josh Rogerson, and Melanie Bukas push all the buttons that make sure that we get on the air.
Jacob Gans is our director. He also brings the tiny Nerf footballs, which we appreciate. My voice just cracked there. That's radio professionalism par excellence. Tricia McKinney is our editor. Laura Conaway is our online editor.
Our senior producer is Matt Martinez. Sharon Hoffman is our executive producer.
Sadly, waving from the news booth is Rachel Martin, because apparently she's not on the show enough. She doesn't get glorified enough during the Bryant Park Project. So let's take a moment to think about Rachel Martin, our newscaster. Great work, lady. I'm Luke Burbank.
And I'm Allison Stewart. Come visit us at our blog, npr.org/Bryant Park. This is the Bryant Park Project. We are from NPR News.
See you tomorrow.